The host of the following program invites your questions and comments live on air by calling 1-888-678-9597. The phone lines are open now. 1-888-678-9597.
Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
At the end of each chapter, I added the 2009 update. So you can simply read the new introduction, the 2009 updates, and the new conclusion, and, you know, what you could do potentially with Crash Proof 1 is you can give that one away because you still have the entire Crash Proof 1, you know, unedited, included in this book. And, you know, one of the other reasons that I wanted to just add the updates at the end was I wanted people who were reading the book for the first time, because hopefully a lot of people will buy Crash Proof 2.0 who never read Crash Proof. I'm hoping the majority of the sales will be to new readers, because now that we've freshened the book up, the bookstores are all ordering it again. They're gonna you know, put it more prominently on display. See, the problem was before is the book was over 2 years old, and it's hard for the publishers to convince the bookstores to promote a two-year-old book. They just normally books that are that old don't even sell. It's kind of weird that my book has been selling better in 2009 than in 2007 when it came out. But hopefully, you know, with a brand new marketing campaign, with a nicer cover, and with the bookstores trying to promote it, I know the publishers have got a promotion going on with the airports. I think my book will be prominently featured in airports for the next few months. You know, I hardly ever saw Crash Proof in an airport. So I think I'm glad that we've got this revision out there. But I don't want, you know, again, don't want people buying it under false pretense, thinking that, you know, they're going to get a brand new book, completely new from cover to cover. That's not what you're getting. And if somebody got that impression because of the wording of on the website, I definitely apologize for that. But still, I think, as I said, I think it's worth it. I think the revisions are good. I think they, you know, could make a short book on their own. Obviously, 80 pages, maybe, you know, a mini book or pamphlet. But, you know, it's definitely worth a read. I spent quite a bit of time, you know, on the updates. Anyway, that's it about Crash Proof. Oh, also, you know, one more thing. I was reading one of the other. Apparently, like a lot of people like to use, you know, my book as their own advertisement. I think somebody with a competing book, you know, went on there under an assumed name and gave me one star. But I think it's pretty funny to look at his criticism, because he's trying to criticize me based on the fact that all my clients lost all their money, which, you know, we all know is not true. But it's funny because he talked about how my clients lost all their money in 2008. And then he also criticized me for being bearish in 2009. And he wrote about how much the stock market is up. You know, basically the inference is my clients lost all their money in 2008 and they didn't make anything in 2009 because we missed out on the rally in U.S. stocks. Which is so ridiculous because, of course, the only reason that I had clients that lost money in 2008 was because they were in foreign stocks, which have gone up a lot more than U.S. stocks in 2009. So you got to give me credit. You can't knock me for 2008 and 2009. If you're going to make fun of me for losses in 2008, you got to at least give me credit for getting the money back in 2009. You can't pretend that I lost money, you know, both years, which I obviously didn't do. But anyway, I thought it was a ridiculous review. But hopefully if we get some more five-star reviews from people who have read the book, you know, those one-star reviews will move down the chain. And certainly on the good reviews that are up there, I mean, if you're on Amazon, if you check that they were helpful, you know, in order to keep the reviews high up, helpful. So if people find the negative reviews not helpful and the five-star reviews helpful, then those reviews will be more prominent. I'm not sure how important these reviews are as far as influencing any purchases on Amazon. You never know. It can't hurt. Anyway, quickly, I know I had a client seminar in Philadelphia this last weekend. I know we had about 400 people there. I think it went pretty well. I don't know if anybody who's calling in today happened to be in attendance, but I know I'm going to be making my next appearance in New Orleans at the investment conference. Unfortunately, I'm only going to be in New Orleans for one day, I think on October 8th. I had to leave quickly because I'm also speaking at a meeting in Hawaii, in Kauai, Hawaii, on October 10th. That one is not open to the public. I think it's for top producing insurance agents around the country. They're having a rewards type meeting, and they have hired me to come speak to this group. And since it's in Hawaii, it was a difficult invitation to turn down. So I had to cut my New Orleans visit short. Normally, I love to stay in New Orleans for the entire conference. It's a great conference. There's a lot of good people down there. I like the city. I like everything about it. So I normally like to stay and hear the other speakers and mingle with the people who are in attendance. But if you do want to come down, again, it's not too late to make a reservation. And I will be there, at least one day. We do have a booth. A couple of Euro Pacific Capital brokers will be there for the entire show. My brother, Andrew Schiff, will also be down there. I think he's also speaking at least once at the event. And on my way back from Hawaii, I'm actually speaking again. It's not members only. I'm speaking at the Hispanic Caucus annual conference in Chicago. So I'm going to be out of town quite a bit. But that's all I've got on the speaking agenda right now. Anyway, let me turn my attention to what's been going on in the markets, what's happening this week. First of all, the Federal Reserve came out today with a statement from its meeting. Again, I mean, nothing really but propaganda, rhetoric coming out of the Federal Reserve. Basically, in Ben Bernanke's statement, he said that economic activity is picking up, the economy is turning around, but nevertheless, he's going to have to keep interest rates at zero for indefinite period of time. Now, number one, I do not think economic activity is really picking up. I think spending is picking up. We're certainly spending more money, but I don't constitute that as legitimate economic activity. We're squandering money. We're running up huge debt. But also, for him to say that the economy is recovering, but that interest rates have to be at zero indefinitely, what does that tell you? It tells you that he knows that there's no real recovery. If the economy really was recovering, why would interest rates have to be so low? I mean, couldn't they nudge them up a little bit? I mean, can't a recovering economy handle interest rates of, say, 1%? After all, when Alan Greenspan slashed interest rates in the last recession, he stopped at 1%. 1% was as low as he was willing to go. Now, apparently, we're no longer even in recession. We're in recovery. And we can't even get back up to the emergency level of 1% of Alan Greenspan. I mean, the truth of the matter is Ben Bernanke knows that this phony economy is on life support. The life support is 0% interest rates and massive government stimulus. And he's not going to pull the plug because he's not comfortable with the political consequences of what would happen. Of course, that's precisely what he has to do. Now, I keep saying that we're never going to have economic recovery until the Fed lets us have a real recession. Now, I know now that I'm, running for Senate in Connecticut, several of my opponents are already starting to make an issue of the fact that, or the Democrats anyway, that Peter Schiff wants the recession, that Peter Schiff is happy or is glad about the recession, right? It's got nothing to do with what I want or what I'm happy about. It's just what I know has to happen. We need the recession, unfortunately, right? It's the unfortunate consequence of the mistakes that were already made, right? If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. What was the crime? The crime was the phony economy, the phony boom. And, the boom was the problem. And booms are what make busts inevitable. I just understand that based on the damage that the government already inflicted to the economy, that the recession is how the market cures us. Maybe it's not fun and maybe it's not pleasant, but that's just the only way to work. It's the only game in town. The alternative is to try to prevent the recession from happening But all that really does is postpone the recession and make it a lot worse. So what I'm saying is, let's have the recession now and get it over with so we don't have a worse recession later that does even more damage. You know, again, I mean, I can say this until I'm blue in the face, but we made the same mistakes in 2001 and 2002. Can't we learn anything from our mistakes? We had a recession then, which we should have allowed to run its course, and it would have been a worse recession. There's no question about it that had the Fed not slashed interest rates to 1%, and had we not had the deficit spending, that the recession in 2001 and 2002 would have been more severe. But we would be much better off now, right? Because we wouldn't have had a housing bubble. We wouldn't have had a subprime industry. We wouldn't have trillions and trillions of dollars of new debt. The government wouldn't now own the automobile industry, the insurance industry, the banking industry. I mean, we wouldn't have all this. And, you know, maybe Barack Obama wouldn't even be president. You know, a lot of things better would have happened had we had that worse recession. So that's my point. I'd rather take the pain now than have more agonizing pain later. You know, I'd rather have prosperity later. And the only way to get that prosperity is to own up and suffer the consequences of what we've done wrong. You know, the path to economic recovery, to real recovery, goes through recession. And there's no way to get from where we are to where we want to be without going through that recession. Just like there's no way for a drug addict to get healthy without going through withdrawal, right? There's just no way to do it. And so just because I understand this doesn't mean I'm happy about it. Doesn't think, I take joy in the fact that there's a recession. I don't. I understand that people are hurting, that people are suffering. But, you know, things like that are going to have to happen. What I do understand is in the long run, there will be rewards. People who lose some jobs will get other jobs and will move on. And the economy will rebalance and grow. But if we try to make everybody feel better, if we try to relieve everybody's suffering, then we're going to create much more suffering for everybody, including the people that we're trying to help. So we have to tackle these problems, and we can't keep demagoguing this issue and try to, you know, vilify anybody who is trying to look for market-based solutions. In fact, it's funny, you know, again, I was quoted, I think, in the Hartford Current recently, and a Democratic spokesman is, you know, lashing out at me, basically saying that I'm a kook, I'm a lunatic, my theories are nonsense, that my theories were tried under George Bush and they failed. My theories weren't tried under George Bush. George Bush is not a free market, you know, cap. You know, I mean, the theories that were tried under George Bush are Barack Obama's theories, are Chris Dodd's theories. That's what was discredited, not mine. Unfortunately, you know, George Bush has become the Herbert Hoover of our generation because he is identified with laissez-faire capitalism, even though his policies are the complete opposite of that. And so now the left is criticizing any real advocate of free markets based on the fact that free markets that were supposedly tried and failed under George Bush when that wasn't the case at all. And, you know, it's funny if you read how this woman describes, you know, my theories are idiotic or crazy, right out of a sci fiction movie. Wait a minute. Why is that? I'm the guy that predicted this stuff. I'm the one that was being laughed at as I described what was going to happen. So if I knew what was going to happen, if I was right where everybody else was wrong, why are my theories the ones that are that are scrutiny? Why are my theories out of science fiction? It's all the other guys. It's the mainstream. It's all the people who got it wrong. Their theories are crazy. They're the kooks, not me. I mean, I'm the one guy among financial pundits or economists. I'm the guy that got it right. You would think that they would at least want to give me the benefit of an open mind and say, okay, yes, he was able to make all these predictions and understood that these things were going to happen. Let's, you know, take a look at where he's coming from. You know, because if he was right about what was going to happen in 2008, 2009, maybe he's right about some other things. And maybe his theories aren't as nutty as we thought. Maybe, just maybe, the people who have been consistently wrong, the people who have never gotten anything right, right, like a Chris Dodd, maybe, just maybe, they're the ones that are espousing theories that are wrong. Maybe they're the ones that are living in some science fiction world. Anyway, I wanted to go to the phones and take your calls. First up is Kent out of Ocala, Florida. Go ahead, Kent.
Yeah, hi. Hey, got a question for you. I've got some cash in a whole life policy, an old one, about $150,000. And I think it's in munis. And I wonder what you would do in a situation like that with that.
Well, you know, my theory is, you know, you don't want to own, you know, whole life policies. I mean, if you need insurance, you know, my gut is to go talk to an insurance agent and buy yourself some term life insurance, which is a much better way to insure against death based on if you have dependents who, you know, would be financially harmed, you know, if you were to die. But as far as an investment, I don't think you want to have $150,000 just sitting around. You know, waiting to be destroyed or debased by Ben Bernanke's printing press. I mean, in a worst-case scenario, the $150,000 is worth nothing. But even in a best-case scenario, you know, the dollar is going to lose a lot of value, probably at least half its value from here, which would reduce that $150,000 to the equivalent of $75,000 worth of buying power. So rather than sitting there like a sheep waiting to be sheared, I would cash it in. I would take that $150,000 and I would do something with it. You know, I would invest it more productively. I mean, what I would do is talk to one of the Euro-Pacific Capital brokers so that he can discuss with you in more detail, you know, the things that we recommend and learn a little bit more about you individually, about what your objectives are and your risk tolerances and things of that nature. But personally, you know, I don't hold any whole life insurance policies. And I don't have any of my own long-term money sitting in U.S. dollar-denominated instruments because I fear that, you know, the purchasing power loss will be horrific. You know, most people worry about, you know, tax shelters. You know, how do I, you know, avoid the income tax? The income tax is bad, but right now the inflation tax is a lot worse and a lot more important because it doesn't just tax your income, it taxes your principal. And so I think tax avoidance of the inflation tax should be the most prominent thing on anybody's mind right now, especially people who have significant sums of money in savings, in dollars.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. Next up is Bob in Wyoming, or West Virginia, rather.
Hello?
Hi, Bob.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Peter, my question is, I just became aware that Germany's gold reserves, all of their gold reserves, are held in the United States. And that doesn't sit well with me. I'm not German or anything, but the idea just brings up two questions. One is if why it ever happened in the first place. And second of all, if Germany or any other country that the United States is holding their gold, if they wanted their money, their gold back, would the United States give it back without any question, or is this some kind of a conspiracy?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I know that the Federal Reserve, you know, holds currency and bullion for other central banks, you know, and we hold that in their vaults. I don't know. I don't know. I'll look into it because I'm curious. I didn't know that we held 100% of Germany's gold reserve.
Yes, I found that out and I confirmed it. So it just didn't sound right to me, and I do thank you.
Yeah, I mean, if I were the Germans, I would be a bit concerned about that situation because, you know, if the price of gold really takes off the way I think it is, and there really is a global financial crisis, I don't know. Maybe the U.S. government will try to seize that gold and use
it
for.
Or if Germany,
you know,
did something that the United States wouldn't approve of, would they?
Yeah, I mean,
would they hold that?
Yeah, I don't
gold?
Know. I mean, look, that would certainly be good for us as Americans. We have it here, but you know, I mean, obviously, you know, we need to honor our commitments. But the United States has a history of not honoring its commitments. Remember, when the dollar was backed by gold, we promised our creditors that for every $35 they had, we would give them an ounce of gold. And when we defaulted. We told them that we're not going to give them anything for their dollars. So we have a history of screwing our international creditors. So I suppose that there's a reason for people to be concerned. I mean, I never would trust politicians. I don't, you know, even foreign politicians. Anyway, next up is Roman in Bergen County, New Jersey.
I would like to know your opinion on the upcoming G20 meeting in Pittsburgh.
On what? Oh, on the G20 meeting.
Oh, yes, G20.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, you know, I did a whole video blog on the G20 meeting yesterday, which if you don't get my video blog, you can see that on my YouTube channel, on Schiff Report on YouTube. But, I mean, basically, this meeting is up in Pittsburgh, and, you know, generally nothing of any significance comes out of it. You know, the U.S. dollar had been falling. It hit a new record, not a record low, but a new low for the year this morning. It seems like it's turning around overnight a little bit. But, you know, any bounce in the dollar, I think, will be short-lived. The currency looks very weak. But, of course, you know, I mentioned that Barack Obama, you know, he put out a communique prior to the G20 that, you know, he wants to work on helping to redress the global economic imbalances, and he wants to pursue policies to increase savings in the United States. Well, you know, there's no point in trying to increase our savings when the government is running a $1.8 trillion annual budget deficit. It doesn't matter how much we save, it's not going to offset that. So, you know, we can increase our savings when the government is squandering all this money. The only way we can increase our savings is if the government stops borrowing. So who's Barack Obama kidding? The whole thing is ridiculous. And then, of course, he's saying he wants the Chinese to pursue policies where they spend more. But at the same time, he wants the Chinese to keep buying our bonds. Well, if the Chinese take their citizens' money to buy our bonds, they can't spend. They can't spend and simultaneously loan to us the same money. It's one or the other. Either they spend their money or loan it to us. So whatever Barack Obama is saying is nonsense. The reality is he wants the global imbalances to continue. He wants Americans to keep spending borrowed money because every program he has is designed to get us to spend money. And their policies are punishing people who save money. So that's what they want. They don't care about the global economic imbalances. They want to make them bigger because in the short run, we feel better. And addressing these global economic imbalances is going to be painful in the United States, and that's the kind of pain that Barack Obama wants to postpone till after the next election, because he doesn't really care about the U.S. economy. He cares about getting reelected. He doesn't care about how much damage his policies do to the long-term health of our economy. He cares, what can we do to get to the next election? How can we make it look like the economy is growing even as it's contracting? Because, you know, all this, you know, new economic growth that they're measuring, all they're measuring is the spending that we're doing. They're ignoring the trillions of dollars of debt that we're taking on in order to pay for that money. They're ignoring the fact that our national balance sheet is weakening. We're going deeper and deeper into debt, which means we're not getting richer, we're getting poorer. Anyway, next up is Ian, I think, in Colorado Springs.
I was wondering, do you think there is any chance that central banks around the world would seize gold to maintain the status of the fiat currencies?
Sure. I mean, you know, central banks have, you know, we've seized gold. I don't know how many other central banks around the world might do it, but you never know. I mean, politicians have been known to do things like that out of desperation. And so as times get tough, you know, they might look for solutions. I think certainly of all the central banks right now, the one that's most likely to seize gold, unfortunately, is probably our own. Because I think we're going to be in a real economic crisis that, you know, is far more devastating than what other countries are going to experience. And so therefore, I think our government is more likely to have to be put in a situation where it would do something like that. You know, and that's why I advocate, you know, having some gold stored out of the country. Keep it safe. Anyway, is Ian still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Yeah. I was also wondering, or give me exposure to international markets, and also give me the ability to hedge through options as well.
I'm not familiar about the hedging area of it. There's certainly a lot of ETFs out there that give you exposure to foreign markets, and some of them may have options associated with them. I'm not really sure. I don't own any of those ETFs myself, and so I don't know. But personally, I prefer to pick the stocks myself and create my own portfolios, which is what I've done with my own account, which is what I'm helping my clients do at Euro Pacific. I've also recently, as I mentioned on this program before, launched a China fund, the Euro Pacific Halter China Fund, to invest exclusively in Chinese companies through a mutual fund. So, you know, that's what I recommend. I mean, if you want to go the ETF route, I mean, as I said, I don't really put out much information on them. You can go and look at them and make sure to look at what they own and concentrate on the basket of stocks because it's not going to change. and you know, make sure you like the companies. You got to make sure the companies are not heavily exposed to the U.S. consumer, that's for sure. You want to try to play the global growth story. You don't want to be dragged down in the U.S., unfortunately, the U.S. contraction story, which unfortunately is going to keep getting worse based on the policies that we're pursuing. Anyway, thanks for the call. Next up is Barry in Los Angeles.
Hi. You had suggested previously that one approach to the U.S. fiscal problem would be to potentially repudiate the debt that is owed by us to some of the foreign governments. The question I had is, if we were to do that, would it be possible that the elimination of that debt would result in an increase in the value of the dollar and therefore a decrease in the price of gold?
If we repudiated our debt? All right, I'm not sure I heard the caller's question. I think he said if the United States repudiated its debt, would the dollar rise? If we simply told our creditors that we weren't going to pay, and therefore we canceled a significant percentage of the national debt, you know, I don't know, because I think the world would be pretty furious with us, and sure, we'd be out of a lot of debt, but I don't think the world would be trading with us. I think, you know, the dollar could actually go down based on that. But, you know, I do think that, you know, the solution to our problems is going to involve some type of repudiation, but I don't think we should just do it unilaterally. I think we should work with our creditors. I think we should negotiate terms where both sides agree to a write down of the debt. Because the reality is, you know, there's no way we can pay back this debt. It's impossible. So either we're going to, you know, repudiate through inflation, which is going to hurt everybody, or we're going to restructure this debt. But I think we need to do it also restructuring our internal liabilities. I mean, the government has promised too much money to everybody. We've promised to repay our creditors the money we've borrowed. We can't do it. We've promised a whole generation of people Social Security and Medicare benefits that we simply can't afford. So we have to level with all of our creditors and all of our liabilities, contingent and uncontingent. We basically have to restructure, you know, because, you know, our politicians have borrowed and promised our way into bankruptcy. And rather than pretending,
Peter, I think you're 100% right. The thing is that if we did all those things simultaneously, if we restructured and said we'll give you 20 cents on a dollar, and we said we'll balance our budget, we'll cut the future entitlements for Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, and we left the remaining currency in place that was not repudiated, wouldn't that enhance the value of the dollar?
I don't know. It might. I mean, certainly the dollar will fall a lot less than it would fall if we didn't do that. The question is, I already think the dollar is very overvalued given, you know, the true productivity of our nation. But I don't know. I mean, you know, my gut is that the dollar would still fall, although it wouldn't collapse completely if we did that. You know, because I think the dollar is going to have to lose value. If you look at, you know, the dollar today versus where it was 10 or 20 years ago, even if we repudiated a significant portion of our debt, we would still be more highly indebted now than we were then. And in addition, we don't have the industrial capacity. We don't have the factories that we did then. And certainly if you look at some of the other currencies like the Chinese RMB and you look at the relative productivity of the Chinese, I mean, there's no way that that currency shouldn't be higher valued relative to ours than it is today. But I agree that if we did do that, then the dollar would not, you know, completely collapse. I mean, the dollar would stabilize, I think, at, you know, a little bit of a lower level than it is at today. But ultimately, it could also appreciate. But we're also going to have to do some other things. We're going to have to get to some other root causes of our lack of productivity. You know, we're going to have to, you know, deregulate, and we're going to have to change our tax, you know, code and everything, and make it so that American businesses, you know, can compete and flourish in a global economy without having to be unduly restrained by onerous regulations and taxes.
Absolutely. And isn't it ironic, if you were successful in your endeavor in Congress and could convince everyone of the problems, then in the end, the investment strategy of Euro-Pacific Capital might end up being to bring your money home?
Yeah. I mean, look, there's nobody in the country probably who would more like to buy U.S. stocks and bonds than me, right? I mean, I've got a whole book of business, a lot of that commission-based, where, you know, I can make myself a tremendous amount of money selling my foreign stocks, charging commissions, and buying domestic stocks and charging commissions. So I have a huge, huge financial interest in moving money back to the United States. But I have a fiduciary responsibility, I think, to my clients not to do that prematurely. And, you know, I would love to be able to invest in U.S. companies and in U.S. securities. But in order to do that, the government has to stop pursuing the policies that are so destructive to those investments, that are undermining our economy, that are taxing our companies, and that are debasing our money. But if I can go to Washington and be successful at reversing those policies and making it appealing once again, then yeah, that's a, you know, that's what we'll do. You know, that's what Reagan and Volcker did. I mean, Reagan and Volcker did that in 1980 when they came in. The world was, you know, was shunning U.S. investments during the 70s. The dollar lost 2/3 of its value. Gold went off the charts. You know, the U.S. stock market went nowhere. You know, but in 1980, when we had a president that understood that the government was the problem and that we needed to rein it in, and we had a Federal Reserve that understood the problems of cheap money and had the courage to raise interest rates to higher levels and had the backing of a president, we, you know, people rushed back to U.S. assets. The problem was, and what undid the benefits of the early Reagan presidency, was the fact that we never got the promised spending cuts. And so spending continued to grow unrestrained, and ultimately we ended up borrowing the money to finance that spending, and we laid the early foundation for the disaster that is in front of us right now.
Well, thanks again, Peter. Good luck in the race. We're supporting you, and we hope you go all the way.
Thank you. And again, anybody who wants to support my efforts to win the Republican nomination in the state of Connecticut and unseat Chris Dodd and go to the U.S. Senate, you know, please do what you can. You know, go to my website at shiftforsenate.com. Contribute as much as you can. You know, the maximum contribution is $4,800 per individual for the primary and the general election. It's $2,400 for the primary, $2,400 for the general. Married couples can give as much as $9,600. I need as much money as I can get to fund this. And also, if you don't have money to give, or even if you do, sign up to be a volunteer. We are working right now on a way to really mobilize the volunteers. I'm going to need as many as I can get. Thousands and thousands of volunteers, the more the better, 10,000 volunteers. We're going to have ways to utilize them. If you have a telephone and you have some free time, we're going to be finding ways to organize the biggest army of volunteers to get out the vote in the state of Connecticut, to educate Connecticut voters about Peter Schiff, and also to help fundraise. So the volunteers can do two things, and we're going to coordinate that. They can work on building my name recognition in Connecticut and getting out the vote for Peter Schiff and drumming up support, and they can also help me with my fundraising. So if you'd like to do that, you know, just go to the Schiff for Senate, sign up, be a volunteer, be in that community, and we will be you know, giving you the volunteers the marching orders soon. And again, you know, it's like a war. You know, maybe I'm the general. I've got some people in my campaign who are the officers who I've hired to run the campaign. But the infantry, the foot soldiers, I think the people that are going to really help me win this thing are going to be the volunteers, right? And so if you want to volunteer to join this Schiff army to liberate our country from those who held it captive in Washington, you know, go to shiftforsenate.com, sign up to be a volunteer, and get your friends to sign up to be a volunteer as well. Anyway, next up is Marty in Pasadena, California.
Hello, Peter.
Hey, Marty.
Peter, thanks for taking the time out. Peter, when you heard the Fed statement today, was this exactly what you expected to hear? And if so, why was it so?
Yeah, well, pretty much the Fed tells the market what the market wants to hear, which is that the economy is improving, but not to worry, interest rates are not going to rise. That's what they want. I mean, the government wants everybody gambling.
Hello, Peter.
The government wants everybody spending money.
I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, I said the government wants everybody spending money. They want everybody borrowing. So they tell the market what the market wants to hear, which is that the economy is getting better, but we're not going to raise interest rates. That's it. I mean, it's all a farce.
And with today's crude oil supply, what's your take on this and how it's going to affect the metals in the near future?
I don't know that it's going to affect the metals. I mean, although, you know, there is some correlation between oil and metals. But look, you know, there's the supply. I think the numbers came out a little bit higher, you know, as far as the build in crude inventory. But look, ultimately, I think crude prices are going higher. I think they're going a lot higher, particularly once the Chinese back away from their support for the U.S. dollar, which is clearly coming based on, you know, all the smoke coming out of Beijing, all the saber rattling with respect to the dollar and their unhappiness with our monetary and fiscal policy and what they're doing with respect to encouraging their citizens to buy gold, floating RMB denominated debt, even though they don't need to borrow money. They're obviously, you know, laying the foundation for some type of move out of the dollar. And when they do that, of course, that is very bullish for crude, because anything that substantially increases the value of the Chinese RMB is going to cause a surge in demand for oil in China. And there's a lot of Chinese. And if the Chinese government makes oil cheaper by revaluing their currency, the Chinese are going to consume a lot more oil. Just simple economics.
Okay.
Anyway, thanks for the call.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
Next up is Ben in North Dakota. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, Mr. Schiff. I have one question and one comment. I've been getting out of the dollar, mainly me and several of the people I know, by investing in the Canadian Energy Trust. And I know the tax laws are going to be changed in 2011, so I've had to choose carefully. What's your outlook on the Canadian Energy Trust here as a whole, I would?
Yeah, well, I've been buying those trusts for my clients, I think, since as early as 95 or 96. And, you know, so they've always been, you know, core holdings for me. Some of the trusts have done a lot better than others. They certainly had some problems. Some of them did. Some of the trusts, you know, have more than recovered their losses in 2008 and made new highs. You know, one of the Canadian trusts was listed in my five favorite investment picks for the next 5 years. I have that special report.
I believe I do own one of those there, that one.
Yeah, and so, you know, I mean, I like some of them more than others. I have a research report also on my website about explaining how Canadian Energy Trusts work, which is free to be downloaded. But, you know, I like them in general. If you want to know which ones I like best or which ones we're buying, you know, just, you know, talk to one of the Euro Pacific Capital brokers about it. You know, even if you don't buy them through our company, if you call up, I mean, you know, any of the brokers will talk to you. But hopefully if you do want to take my investment advice, you know, open up an account and let us, you know, handle your trades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one comment I was here, again, I hear you talking about Reagan and Volcker here, and my dad still actually has silver that my grandpa bought in the 1970s as a hedge against inflation. Because I've talked to people that say, you know, well, you know, who does that here? But my grandpa and people like him in the 70s, they were buying silver for and actually using it there for buying and selling there because of the high inflation at the time. So,
yeah, you know, and the big key was a lot of people did not, you know, connect the dots of Reagan and Volcker, and they held their gold and silver and other assets too long. You know, if mm-hmm. they would have understood what those two were putting in place, they would have repatriated their money. They would have bought treasuries that were paying 14%. They would have bought the Dow Jones below 1,000. And so hopefully I don't make the same mistake with my clients. I don't want to miss a real new bull market in U.S. stocks and bonds. But the problem is right now, nothing is happening at this point to even give me a clue that we're turning the corner, because mm-hmm. Barack Obama is the polar opposite of Ronald Reagan, and Ben Bernanke is the polar opposite of Paul Volcker, even though Paul Volcker is somehow a part of the Obama administration. Obviously, nothing is rubbing off on Bernanke, and, you know, if he's given Obama any advice, obviously they're ignoring it.
Yeah, so, yeah, I thought I'd throw that comment out. So you have a very good evening, sir.
All right, sure. Thanks a lot for the phone call. Next up is Rick in Long Island. Go ahead, Rick.
How you doing, Peter? Can you hear me? I heard a little static.
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Great. I had two questions for you. The first is, in recent months, you had spoken about the currency, or I should say a currency crisis, being here as early as the fall, and around that time you would also talk about hyperinflation being a few years off. So I was wondering if you could distinguish between the two.
Well, hyperinflation, and I don't know how many years off that may be, it would occur. I mean, hyperinflation is not, you know, what we had in the 1970s. That was high inflation. And even if we get inflation rates of, you know, 12, 15% or 20%, I wouldn't classify that as hyperinflation. You know, if we had, if the inflation rate were 20% a month, then that's a little bit, you know, more in the ballpark. I don't know how long it will take to get to that level of inflation, but we can certainly be at double-digit inflation in the next couple of years. I would not be surprised at all for that to happen. But I'm hoping that we can reverse course in policy to avoid a hyperinflation scenario. But that's out there. You know, none of the countries that have, you know, been unfortunate enough to be, you know, victimized by hyperinflation, none of the governments set out deliberately to create hyperinflation. And if you remember, you know, Germany, you know, which had the Weimar Republic, you know, Germany was a wealthy industrial country. You know, certainly going into the First World War, you know, Germany was a major industrial power. They were a wealthy, wealthy country. And, you know, when they lost the war, you know, they still, you know, they still had their industry. I mean, you know, but what they had was a lot of debt, you know, a lot of war reparations. But the politicians, you know, went down the road of printing money, and, you know, they unleashed this, you know, hyperinflation. And, you know, if it can happen in a country like Germany, it can happen in a country like the United States. And so we just have to be careful not to get out of hand. But unfortunately, sometimes it does, because the politicians are reluctant to do the right thing. And, of course, the longer they wait to do the right thing, the more difficult doing the right thing becomes, because the consequences are that much worse. That's the reason, you know, that I really like to get it out of the way, get the recession out of the way now. You know, take our medicine now before it ends up being much more bitter and harder to swallow.
Okay. Question number two, what do you make of the gold and silver ratio, and do you look for that to narrow as the price of gold climbs?
Yeah, I mean, historically, whenever you have major metals bull markets, you know, silver, you know, closes in on gold. And so I would expect, if history is any guide, that the same thing to happen again. So on the upside, you know, if gold does go to, let's say, 5,000, which would be a fivefold increase, you know, if, you know, I think silver will be, you know, not $100 an ounce, but maybe $200 an ounce, which would mean that the gold silver ratio would be cut in half, and, you know, and so maybe silver could be higher than that. Certainly, if you look at what happened in the 1970s, silver got to $50 when gold was at $850. That is probably a record low in that ratio. Could something like that happen again? Maybe, you know. But I own both gold and silver. I think, you know, I think it also works in reverse. If for some reason we had a big drop in the price of gold, and the price of gold got cut in half back to $500. Silver prices might lose 2/3 of their value or 3/4 of their value. So, you know, it's you get more reward, but you take more risk.
Okay. Thanks. By the way, I am a Europac client, and I'm also a recovering Catholic. And the reason I bring that up is to tell you that you're the second Jew I've ever worshipped in my life. Congratulations.
I didn't catch the end of that comment, but.
Jew I've ever worshipped in my life. Congratulations.
Oh, well, you don't want to worship me, but I appreciate your business. Anyway, thanks for the call. Next up is Jake in Boone, North Carolina. Yeah, I mean, Jake, are you there? Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I'm sorry. For some reason, my phone wasn't working. I have a real quick question for you. First of all, just wanted to thank you. My wife and I are both huge fans, and you really saved our bacon here. But my question has to do with purchasing a home. My wife and I ultimately want to kind of get a self-sustaining piece of property, maybe 40 acres, and clearly now is not the time to do it. But I've actually heard you say two different things, and I was wondering what is the smartest way to do it. I heard you mention that it might be smart prior to an inflation or hyperinflation period to get a loan and use get fixed interest and use the inflation to pay off the loan. But then I also heard you say, I believe it was last week, that it might make sense until interest rates go higher and home prices come down, and then to go in and purchase a piece of property with cash. So I was just wondering, what's the smartest way?
Yeah, you know, there's no way to know. I mean, I think personally, I'm still renting my house here because in order for me to buy the house that I'm living in, the down payment would be substantial that the banks would require because I'm living in, you know, a rather large home. And so I would certainly have to put a 20% down payment. And I simply do not want to take 20% of my money that is invested in foreign stocks or precious metals and use it as a down payment on a house. Because I do think if there is massive inflation, I think that that 20% down payment money alone will be worth well in excess of the entire purchase price of this house today. So I would rather leave it there and continue to rent, especially given that the rent that I'm paying now, even if I did make, if I took, you know, some of my foreign stocks and sold them and gave up the income and made a 20% down payment, my mortgage payment would be well in excess of what my rent is. So I think I'm better off renting. But, you know, from another perspective, if you can get an FHA home and you can get a home with 3.5% down payment, and if you get a tax credit of $8,000 because you haven't bought a house in the last 3 years, basically you're getting paid to buy a house. So if the government pays you to buy a house and gives you a 30- or 40-year loan mortgage at an artificially low rate, then it's a different story because then you've got no actual skin in the game, but you've got a house where if there's massive inflation, that will wipe out your debt and you'll own the house for free. See, my thinking is since I have to put a 20% down payment, if I keep that 20%, you know, let's say in gold and we have massive inflation, I'll still be able to get a free house because I'll be able to take that down payment and buy an entire house without a mortgage. But if you're talking about one of these FHA mortgages, I probably would get one. Unfortunately, I wouldn't qualify, and the house that I'm living in wouldn't qualify.
Well, if my wife and I are in a position to purchase a piece of property outright with cash, would it be smarter to do that when the interest rates are higher, or would it be smarter to try to play the inflation game here?
No, if you buy it with cash, you're not going to benefit from the inflation game. The key on inflation is to have debt. So, I would not buy a house for cash right now. I don't think that makes sense. Personally, I would rent a house if I had a bunch of cash, and I would take that cash instead of buying a house, invest it, open up an account with Europe Pacific. If you want to buy real estate, we could buy your real estate in Asia, buy some commercial property, get some dividends. And I think you want to keep your money out of U.S. assets right now because I think they're going to lose a lot of value, U.S. real estate.
I'm actually talking maybe like 2 years down the road. Right now, my wife and I have protected our money with metals, and we're pretty much exclusively in metals. So I'm thinking more, we have two kids, where I'm thinking, maybe 2 years down the road, once all this monetary policy, once the effects start to kick in.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to take more than 2 years for the effects to fully kick in, and 2 years is kind of too short a time horizon to really, make any investments. I mean, what I'm doing is, I am going to rent my house until it makes sense to buy. And in the meantime, I'm going to invest my money where I think I can get a better return. So that's what you just determine what you want to do. I mean, do you want to, throw your money into a house, or do you want to have it someplace else? I mean, and for some people, it depends on the property and where it is. I mean, there might be some parts of the country where buying is not that bad a deal right now. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm living in my market in Fairfield, County, Connecticut. I can look around. I can see what the asking price for homes are. I know what the rental prices are. I can do the math. I can figure it out. Plus, I also think that there's, still a major contraction coming in the New York economy and in financial services on Wall Street. And I think that's going to affect the ability of a lot of people to pay for expensive homes in commuting distance of New York City. And I think there's a lot of people that own a lot of these homes that are going to lose a lot of money in other places. And I think a lot of homes are going to be on the market. And I can look around. I see a lot of for sale signs, a lot of new constructions, and no buyers. So to me, it looks like there's a glut on the market and prices are going to go down. I don't want to buy into a glut. I'd rather wait.
Absolutely. Real quick, I'll finish this up because I know you have more callers. But so basically, if I hear you correctly, then you're saying clearly wait, which is what I was going to do anyway. But when the time comes, do it with cash when the interest rates are much higher so that home prices have come down, as opposed to waiting until it all hits, inflation's hitting, and trying to get a loan and paying it off with inflation, because clearly you can't do both.
Right, but personally, I wouldn't want to sit with a bunch of dollars because it's possible
absolutely
that we can
not
have hyperinflation instead. So you got to have your money, again, like you said, in gold or silver. And then when the property market collapses and interest rates are, you know, double digits and it's hard to get a loan, you won't need a loan because you'll be able to buy a house for gold. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Thanks a lot. Good luck to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let me take the last caller of the evening. It's only about 5 minutes left, so no more calls. It's Carl in Evansville, Indiana.
Hey, Peter.
Or Cal.
It's Cal, actually. Yeah.
Okay, Cal, go ahead.
My question is, how does the Fed's ability to control money electronically affect inflation? Can't they instantaneously add or subtract liquidity from the system through computers?
Well, they use computers. I mean, the way the Federal Reserve creates money, it's not simply running off the printing presses, even though that's how we refer to it. But what they do is they credit bank accounts at the Fed, electronically with money. That's what they do with the U.S. government. When the Fed, buys Treasury debt, it doesn't physically print money and give it to the Treasury. It simply credits the Treasury's account at the Federal Reserve with an additional balance, and then the Federal Reserve is able to spend that money on whatever it wants. And so certainly with the electronic creation of money, it certainly makes it quicker, and they don't need ink and they don't need paper. So I would imagine that under our current system, where money can be created electronically, we can do it a lot faster than the old-fashioned way. So I think we potentially can have even more rapid inflation, because we don't have to worry about the costs or the time to actually print the stuff up.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Anyway, we just got a few minutes left. Let me thank everybody again for listening. As far as I know, it looks like my schedule is clear to do the show next Wednesday, which will be Wednesday the 30th. I should be able to do the show. As far as I know, I'm going to be doing it Wednesday the 30th. As far as Wednesday the 7th, I think I'll probably still be able to do that one. The only time I might have a difficulty is when I'm going to be in Hawaii on October the 14th. So that might be a guest host. But as far as I know, the next couple of Wednesdays, I will be around. I mean, don't forget, if you haven't already opened up an account at Euro Pacific Capital, I think it's important that you try to get your financial house in order, that you make the appropriate investments before the bottom really drops out of our currency. So if you haven't done it, I'm going to talk to one of the reps at Euro Pacific Capital, just about what we do and what we can help you with, and to find out, if our approach makes sense for you. Give us a call at 800-727-7922. That's 800-727-7922. Talk to a broker. I know there's probably still some brokers working out on the West Coast tonight, even though it's almost 9 o'clock on the East Coast. And there might even be some of the East Coast guys working late. So give them a call or give them a call tomorrow. Again, don't forget to pick up a copy of Crash Proof 2.0. Even if you read the original, there are 80 new pages that I think are worth reading. And you never know, you can give the original to a friend. Although you might want to hold on to it as a collector's item, because Wiley is taking them out of print. They are going to destroy all copies in their inventory, so you will no longer have copies of Crash Proof, the original, on the shelves. The only book that will be for sale will be Crash Proof 2.0. And again, if you like the book, go on Amazon or go on Barnes & Noble and write a review, give it 5 stars, hopefully, if you think it deserves 5 stars, and let people know why they ought to read it. And again, remember, go to shiftforsenate.com, make a contribution, sign up to be a volunteer. This is going to be a long, expensive campaign, but I'm in this thing to win this thing, and I can't win it without help. And hopefully the people who listen to this show are willing to help with their time, with their money, to make sure that I make it to the U.S. Senate and help take back this country. Anyway, that's it, everybody. You've been listening again to Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, president of Euro Pacific Capital, Senate candidate in the great state of Connecticut. Thanks, everybody. I will be back again with a live episode of Wall Street Unspun, midweek market update. Thanks, everybody. So long.